hated that. That was just raising the bar really high. They didn't used to introduce me like that whenever I would speak here, just so you all know. Yeah, so I was going to introduce myself, but I guess I don't have to do that anymore. I've been on staff here for quite a while. 2011 is when I graduated, came on staff. But a lot of you probably don't recognize me because, yeah, my wife and I moved to Scotland about a year and a half ago and just got back right before December. So it was a great time, but we are excited to be back. So you'll still see me around here, but also over at the library or coffee shops doing some studying, working on the PhD. I did like the part about me being smarter than Brian. I thought that was right on. So a lot of you I don't know. I'd love to get to know you. Please come up, introduce yourselves to me. But I thought it might help you get to know me a little bit better if we played a little game up front. So have you guys heard of two truths and a lie? Okay. So how it's going to work is I'm going to tell you three things about my time in Scotland, and you have to see if you can pick out which of those is the lie. So here we go. See if I can fool you. The first one is, my wife Bethany and I went on a boat on Loch Ness and went hunting for the Loch Ness Monster. And it was this guy, it was what he did for his job. He took people out on a boat. He had like scuba gear and radar. We didn't go scubing, but he had it and was ready to roll looking for the Loch Ness Monster. That was his life, which was kind of crazy. So that's the first thing. Number two, on a visit to Edinburgh, we casually ran into Prince Charles. So seeing royalty was pretty cool. He's next in line. He's after the Queen, if anyone knows who that is. Not the Queen, but it's Prince Charles. So we saw him casually on the street in Edinburgh one day. The third thing is I played golf on the Old Course, which is one of the most historic and oldest courses in the world. That's where they play the British Open every few years. I played it like 10 times. I could play it all the time throughout the year. So those are my three things. Now let's see if you can pick out the lie. Now if you know the answer, you might know me, you might know my wife, you might follow her on Instagram, so you can't vote if you know the answer. So by a show of hands, who thinks number one is the lie? Not a lot of people, that's the Loch Ness Monster. Who thinks number two, Prince Charles, is a lie? Okay, more. Who thinks number three, Old Course? Whoa! Wow, I really fooled you guys. So number one is the lie. We did see the Loch Ness Monster. We did not see the Loch Ness Monster. We saw Loch Ness, no Nessie sightings. Here's the Prince Charles sighting. We have the photo, I think. That was kind of weird. We didn't even know he was going to be there, and he like walks out of this building, so snap this photo. Some of you probably appreciate the golf thing. So I do have some video evidence of this. Some of you don't care. You're like, whatever. So there's this hole number 17 is sort of one of these particularly difficult holes. You almost have to hit it over a hotel. It's like a little bit left of the hotel, but you have to hit it over a building, blind shot. You don't know where your ball is going to land. Well, on this particular day, I just want to show you all my drive. See if you can follow the ball really carefully and see what happens here. So check this out. Yeah. If you couldn't tell by my face, it did not go well. My slice reared its ugly head, and the ball went crashing into this $600 a night hotel. Hey, I blame them for building a hotel by the golf course. It happens all the time. But it was really fun to play the Old Course, play golf. Playing golf was a good way to sort of blow off steam in between classes and studying. But I am glad to be back here around CSF, as much as I'll miss the golf. So when Brian asked me to come and speak at Synergy, I was excited. Like, I jumped at the chance. I was like, yes, definitely, I'm in. When do you want me to talk? And he said, well, how about Valentine's Day for Sex Synergy? And I got a little less excited and a little more nervous. So I used to speak around here fairly often, but I literally haven't been on a stage speaking in front of anyone in 2 years. And so my first Synergy back, I get to talk about the most awkward, invasive topic of the year, your sex lives. So this should be fun. I'm looking forward to it. As many of you will have noticed, though, it's a little different. It's a little different tonight. We're talking about a theology of sex. So we're going to put sex under a little bit of a theological microscope, if you will. So at times, it might feel a little dense. It might feel a little dense or heady at times, but just stick with me, because I think this is really important. Because I really believe that what you think about something and how you think about something actually matters for how you live into that thing. So I really think tonight matters a great deal. And so to help us frame the night, I'm going to give you two truths and a lie about sexuality. Unlike the game, I'm going to tell you as we go along which is the truth and which is the lie. But by the end, I hope that I will have provided a fuller picture of this Christian vision for sexuality. But let's start at a backyard barbecue in Scotland. So this was last summer. It was a beautiful Scottish summer day, really warm. It was like 70 degrees outside. And it was one of my friend's birthdays, but we just really wanted an excuse to sort of get together and grill some meat. So we were all hanging out at this in this guy's backyard, and I knew most of the people there. There was a lot of people there, but not everybody. And I was standing by the grill. My buddy was working the grill, and we were just kind of chatting. And a guy walked up who I hadn't met. His name was Luke, and he introduced himself, and we got to talking. He was an undergraduate student from somewhere in Europe, and so he's quite a bit younger than I was. And in the middle of this conversation, Luke sort of took a 180. He looked me right in the eye and he said, "Why'd you get married?" And I was like, "Okay, I just met you, but that's fine. That's cool." I was a little taken aback, a little surprised by the question, but it was an honest question and genuine. So what ensued was an hour-long conversation about marriage. Like, don't ask me questions, so okay, unless you want to get an hour-long conversation. Joking. Anyway, so we were joined by this other couple. They sort of joined our conversation. They'd been dating for about 2 years, had no intentions of getting married. And all three of them, none of them were Christians, and all three just found the idea of marriage just like preposterously silly. Like, they're like, why do people get married? We don't even understand this. And I remember what one of them said. One of them called marriage a pointless social construct. And my response to this was, well, I don't think it's pointless or a social construct. And this brings us to truth number one. Sex and marriage were made good by God for a purpose. And I think here we have to start in the beginning, in the garden with Adam and Eve, the first man and first woman, two naked farmers put in the middle of paradise. And they were given one command: be fruitful and multiply. Translation: have lots of sex and make some babies. This is the picture that God says is good. He says it's very good, in fact. Adam and Eve are in love. Adam is singing in Genesis 2. Adam is singing poetry over Eve. It's so beautiful. And then this next verse, it says in Genesis 2:24, it says this: therefore, a man leaves his father and mother and clings to his wife, and they become one flesh. Now, in Hebrew culture, this one flesh thing, this is a clear reference to marriage. But notice what the author has done here. So in Genesis 2, the entire story has been about Adam and Eve, this particular specific man and particular specific woman. And then all of a sudden, in 2:24, the author jumps back and says, therefore, a man, it makes a general statement, a man and his wife, they become general. He moves from the specific to the general. And so this is important. It means that Adam and Eve aren't just the first marriage. They are the ideal. They are the vision of what marriage is and supposed to be. Man and woman in complete intimacy with one another and no one else. This is before the serpent. This is before sin. This is before the fall. Marriage and sex are good, very good. But they're not just good and beautiful, although they are, but they also serve a purpose. And that purpose is, of course, part of what makes them good and beautiful as well, but you know the purpose: to make life, right? This purpose for marriage and sexuality has been, from the beginning, procreative. And I think there's a real irony in the modern view of sex. You'll hear a lot of people say something like, look, sex is natural. There shouldn't be this social stigma against just having sex for fun and sleeping around, because sex is natural. But the irony is how unnatural we've had to make it to divorce sex from procreation. I mean, multiple layers of birth control that often mess with women's hormones and condoms and abortion, anything to stop this natural process that sex is connected to. Of course, most people recognize, they intuitively get that sex is connected to procreation, that it's about making babies. Most of us have had the birds and the bees talk from someone. But what about marriage? Like, what does marriage have to do with kids? Well, it turns out a great deal, because it turns out that God does not just care about babies being made, he cares about them being raised in stable, committed environments. Former President Barack Obama recognized this, and speaking at a church on Father's Day a few years back, here's what he said. He said, "If we are honest with ourselves, we'll admit that too many fathers are missing from too many lives and too many homes. They have abandoned their responsibilities, acting like boys instead of men, and the foundations of our families are weaker because of it. We know the statistics that children who grow up without a father are 5 times more likely to live in poverty and commit crime, 9 times more likely to drop out of schools, and 20 times more likely to end up in prison. They are more likely to have behavioral problems or run away from home or become teenage parents themselves, and the foundations of our communities are weaker because of it." Now, of course, he's not saying that if you grow up without a father, if you grow up without a mother, or both, that you're just screwed and you have no chance in life. But he is recognizing, and with the data to back it up, that children are most likely to flourish when they're in an environment where the mom and the dad are committed to one another. Far from being a pointless social construct, marriage and with it sex are good gifts created by God for a purpose. Well, that answer didn't go over particularly well by the grill that day. I was still waiting for my chicken kebab. And the question that they wanted to know, that they just kept asking, they said, "Look, why can't we have that without marriage? Like, why do we need this ceremony to prove our love? Why can't we be in a committed, loving relationship? And why can't we have kids without the ceremony?" And in that moment, of all things, this is really random, but in that moment, of all things, the one thing that kept coming to my mind was the TV show Parks and Rec. Do we have any Parks and Rec fans in the house? I thought so. I too am a Parks and Rec fan. I've probably seen the entire series 2 or 3 times. And in fact, when the conversation by the grill happened that day, I think my wife and I were in the middle of another binge through the show. Well, for some reason, while we were watching the show this particular time, the wedding ceremonies sort of stuck out. Something seemed a little different or a little off. And so I'm going to talk about some of these ceremonies. And so if it's okay with you all, I'm going to show some clips. 3 little clips, short clips from the wedding ceremonies. So just pay attention. We'll talk about them when I get back. So have a look. If you've never seen Parks and Rec, you're out there, you're like, who are these weirdos? Like, what is happening here? So, of course, these ceremonies, they're all so cute, right? And they all capture so well. That's what is so impressive about them. Each of them so perfectly encapsulates the characters that are getting married. But again, there was something that stuck out to me that was missing. And I noticed that in these ceremonies, there were no promises. There were no vows, no commitments. And in the place of vows, each character just sort of listed a bunch of characteristics that they liked about the other. Now, I don't want to overstate my case here. Of course, any wedding ceremony, no matter how terrible it is or might be, it doesn't necessarily show what kind of marriage a couple will have. Nonetheless, ceremonies teach us what a couple values or should value in their marriage. In that Genesis passage above, we are told that husband and wife leave their old lives and cling to one another. That is, not just be close to, but be committed to. And this is truth number two. Truth number two is the commitments of marriage reflect the faithfulness of God. The commitments of marriage reflect the faithfulness of God. In the Bible, we see this in both the Old and the New Testaments. In the Old Testament, marriage is called a covenant. Now, this seems like a sort of dusty, outdated old word, but it's actually really theologically rich and significant. This same word, covenant, is used to describe God's relationship with Israel. It conveys the idea of a solemn commitment. The faithfulness that God shows Israel then, despite Israel's unfaithfulness, and despite Israel's imperfections, is the same kind of faithfulness that a husband is supposed to have for his wife and the wife for the husband.
In the New Testament, Paul adopts the same idea in Ephesians 5, where he argues that husbands and wives are to be joined to one another. And here's what he said. Don't miss this. He says, they are to love one another like Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. In biblical or theological terms, then, a marriage is precisely a reflection of God's faithfulness towards his unfaithful people. We make binding promises at a wedding altar for this reason, to tell another person that we will love them with the love of Christ, forsaking all others for as long as we both shall live. Now, talked about Parks and Rec for a second. Do we have any Office fans in the crowd? I regret to inform you, I'm not going to be showing any clips from The Office. I know, boo, bring it on. But I will take you there mentally, if that helps. So in the final episode of the final season of The Office, the main character, it's a heartbreaker. The main characters, Dwight and Angela, are wed. You remember the scene? Okay, do you remember where they're standing? In their graves, right? They're standing in their own graves, their burial plots, as is the Schrute tradition. And it's kind of quirky and kind of weird, but it's actually a really powerful symbol. Because the marriage, in the ceremony, the minister reminds them why they're standing in their graves. He says, you're standing in your own burial plots because this is the only escape from what you're about to do. Now, it's kind of morbid, and it's kind of, again, weird and quirky, like everything Dwight does. But I think this is actually a depiction of the kind of faithfulness imagined by marriage as a covenant. Now, there's a really difficult implication of this. Some of you might have already thought of it. This difficult implication is this, that it means that marriage isn't ultimately about my happiness or my fulfillment. And this is where our conversation by the grill that day ultimately led. I finally had my chicken kebab. I was very happy about that. And halfway through it, between bites, I remember saying something like, yeah, you know, my marriage, it just isn't really about my happiness. And I'll never forget it, the look on their faces. It was as if I had just told them that the sky was red. It's not that they disagreed, though they did. It was because they had just never heard such a thing. And this is the lie that we're told by our culture, that sex is about my fulfillment and my happiness. This lie is virtually everywhere today. The lack of vows or commitments in the Parks and Rec ceremonies, I think it suggests this, that more important than your commitment to another is being true to yourself. The important value here, you do you. That's the value articulated in these ceremonies. Philosopher Charles Taylor has called our culture a culture of authenticity. According to him, this means that the goal of life is increasingly conceived as creating oneself, breaking off from any authority imposed on us from the outside. And you see this in the Parks and Rec ceremony. Toss out the vows. Toss out the conventional wedding forms and institutions and opt instead for being authentic. Now, most of us just accept this. Yes, yeah, we should be true to ourselves. We should live authentically. And I'm not saying that these things are bad necessarily or that they're always bad, but I am suggesting that our culture shapes us and forms us and teaches us things, even when we don't realize it. It invites us to think and behave in certain ways, and not all of those ways are good. In a culture of authenticity, my desires, my will, my happiness, and my fulfillment are central, and these outweigh all other goods. One of the results of this is that sex becomes about my happiness. This has produced what David Bentley Hart calls a pornography culture. So another description of the kind of culture that we live in. And a pornography culture is this. It means that our lives are filled with sex like never before. Social media, TV commercials, radio, billboards, for goodness sakes, sex is everywhere. You cannot watch a Super Bowl halftime show without someone taking their clothes off. Thanks for that. Somebody like that, at least, yeah. Hart points out this. He makes this joke about the pornography culture and some of the subtle ways that it affects us. He says this. He says, the spectrum of wit explored by television comedy runs largely between the pre- and post-coital. Translating this to layman's terms, comedy TV shows make almost exclusively sex jokes today. Now, don't hear me laying a guilt trip on you if you watch these shows. I watch these shows. But I do think that we should be aware, we as in the people that watch these shows, the kinds of subtle effects they can have on us. And of course, not just these shows, but the larger popular culture in which we engage. Now, some of you out there that do know me or remember me from a few years ago, my favorite baseball team is the Chicago White Sox. I'm a big fan, I'm a follower, and a few years ago, they traded for this young phenom named Yoan Moncada. Those of you that follow baseball may remember this trade they did with the Red Sox. He came from the Red Sox. Well, the Red Sox signed Yoan Moncada out of Cuba when he was 19 years old, and they gave him $31.5 million to come play baseball for them. I'd go play baseball for $31.5 million. I would. So imagine this, right? Moncada is fresh out of Cuba. He's 19 years old, and he's just been given $31.5 million. What do you do? Well, Moncada started buying Twinkies, and this is reported by ESPN, so you can take that for what it's worth. But according to his agent, Moncada was consuming around 85 Twinkies per week, or about 12 Twinkies per day when he first came over to the United States. Yeah, that deserves a round of applause. That's how we do it in America, right? Now, this is really hard to fathom. It's hard to imagine how someone could eat that many Twinkies. Moncada is a world-class athlete, and somehow, by the grace of God, his body has remained unaffected by this. But for most of us mere mortals, that wouldn't fly. Some of you may have wonderful metabolisms. I hate people like that, but you may have wonderful metabolisms and be able to handle that, but just wait a few years. It won't fly for long. So now, let's say I started eating a Twinkie after every meal. Not 12 a day, but just, you know, 3 Twinkies a day. I think there's a good chance that I wouldn't notice any effects after a few days, right? Probably even a few weeks or months. Like, I might gain a few pounds, but not a whole lot else. But I suspect that prolonged exposure to Twinkies would be pretty terrible for my body. I'd say after a few years, the effect would be very noticeable. And I think this is actually similar to how the pornography culture works on us. This constant barrage of sex is just slowly shaping us and forming us. Unlike the Twinkies, we may never notice the changes, but they are changes. Of course, more than this barrage of sexual insinuations in our TV shows and advertisements, the pornography culture shapes us by, well, you guessed it, pornography. For our grandparents, when they were young, the closest that you could get to pornography was going to a physical building and seeing a strip show. For our parents, when they were young, the closest you could get was getting a magazine, right, hiding it in your room. For us, nearly all of us have unfettered access to free high-definition pornography in our pockets at all times. How, we might ask, or we should ask, will it be for our children? Now, at the center of this, the really fundamental driving force is not technology. You might think it is. It's not technology. Technology is a tool that enables this, but it's not the driving force. The driving force is the exercise of the will. My pursuit of happiness, or pursuit of my fulfillment. My sex life can be catered to my desires and my fantasies without ever having to leave my couch, much less commit to another person. Sex becomes explicitly all about me. My desires, my fulfillment, my will. In his essay, Hart writes this very haunting line. He says, "We are devoted to, indeed, in a sense, we worship the will. And we are hardly the first people willing to offer up our children to our God." This is the story that our culture is telling. That sex is about you. I mean, you can listen in to the cultural conversations about sexuality, about homosexuality, or about sexual identity. These conversations revolve primarily around whether a person's sexual expression is their fundamental human right. And we hardly ever stop to think whether there are any other goods at play, or any other goods that might be relevant. This is the culture of authenticity. This is the way that our sex lives and imaginations are being shaped and formed in the cultural waters in which we swim. But we are invited into another story, a different vision for sexuality. Let's call this a sexuality of the cross. At the heart of a sexuality of the cross is this paradox, that in the life-giving, life-forsaking death of Jesus, there's also life, and life in abundance. "For anyone who seeks life will lose it," says Jesus, "but the one who loses their life for my sake will find it." Marriage is not ultimately about my happiness and my fulfillment, but a good marriage and a good sex life, rightly ordered, will be fulfilling and will make you happy. The Jesus-given paradox says that only in death do we receive life. For some of you, for many of you, this life-giving love probably will look like marriage. This means a giving up yourself like Christ did for the church kind of love for another human being, and there is goodness and beauty there. But for some of you, it might look like celibacy. The Christian tradition has a long history of affirming the goodness of celibacy, that it does not doom you to a life of loneliness, but can provide a positive vision of community no less predicated on giving up yourself for another person. Again, a positive vision for living a faithful, committed life of sexless singleness that is life-affirming and life-giving. And this really just serves to underscore the main point that marriage and sex is not ultimately about my happiness and my fulfillment. They are fundamentally about giving up your life, and it is only here that fulfillment and happiness can truly be found. This invitation to give up your life is an invitation offered to all people, regardless of what sex lives you've lived in the past. One of the most striking stories in all of Scripture is John chapter 8. There's a woman caught in adultery and sexual sin, and she's brought before Jesus. The law says she is to be stoned. She's to be killed. Jesus stands between the woman and the stones. He looks her in the eye, and he says, "I do not condemn you. Go now and leave your life of sin." In Jesus, there is forgiveness for sexual failures. There is forgiveness when we have made sex about our own happiness and fulfillment. And I would bet there's not a person in the room tonight that hasn't done that at some point. There is forgiveness and not condemnation. And yet, thankfully, there is also a way forward. To go now and leave our lives of sin, to follow Jesus to the cross, that is, by our giving up ourselves, our own pursuit of self-fulfillment, our pursuit of our own happiness, to follow Jesus to the cross so that we too can follow him to new life and life to the full. Let's pray. Oh God, the strength of all who put their trust in you. In our weakness, we can do nothing good without you. Give us the help of your grace that in keeping your commandments, we may please you in both will and deed. Through Jesus Christ, our Lord, who lives and reigns with you in the Holy Spirit, one God, forever and ever. Amen.